Thank you, Liz. I've sort of been thinking recently at our current church up at Hills Baptist Hallgate. We've had some people there. There's been, obviously, we do like a pastoral prayer and we have little talks from the worship leader and things like that. And one of the comments that's been coming forward, especially off the congregation, is they're quite worried by the state of the world, but not so much the state of the world, the state of Australian society in general at the moment. Some of the things that are filtering in and some of the things that are commonly being going and put around out there, and some of the things that maybe some of the culture that might be seeping into the church has been of great sort of worry to them. And it got me on another track thinking. When I was at the, for you who don't know, I'm a former police officer. I was based over in New South Wales for the majority of my time. And when I was there at the academy, we'd walk past a certain area and there would be the police security group and there would be basically where our version of the sergeant major of the academy would sit. And outside of the office was a big poster. And it was a study done in the United States. And it was basically on, officers' appearance and presentation and taking pride in themselves, how internally they saw their job and how that presented on the outside. But the study itself wasn't done from police officers. It was done from criminals who had attacked them and sometimes had a successful attack on a police officer. And what they said was the simple fact that those officers that had presented well, that looked like they couldn't be overtaken or be overrun, the criminals didn't tend to steer towards them. Those that were on top of their game, the criminals didn't want to deal with them. But those who weren't, those who seemed a bit lacklustre, those who seemed not to have it together, they were the ones that they would attack, they were the ones that they were spying upon, and they were the ones that often the action would happen against. And I guess this gets into the point of how do we, as a church as a whole, interact with ourselves, and how do we interact with God? And I guess it leads to the point of, if we're called to be evangelistic, what does that mean if we're not together, if we don't have that all, and our hearts just aren't simply there? How do we approach God and deal with each other in matters of faith? How are our hearts aligned towards God as a collective, as a collective of people, as a collective church? And I guess in that, I'm going to use a cold chiselism here, but standing on the outside looking in, probably from East, one of their best albums. What does that look like for an outside observer if we are messy inside and if we are facing challenges going forward? What does that look like? So I'm just going to quickly read again from the passage, and as we go through, we'll do two quick readings again. So if you can turn to Exodus 32, 1-7, that would be fantastic. When the people saw that Moses was so long coming down the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." And Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives and your sons and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me." He took what they'd handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there is a festival to the Lord." So the next day, the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. As we're delving into this, I think it's just a bit of a structural thing, just to get a background on exactly where this is sitting in the story of ancient Israel. Basically, they've had their flight out of Egypt. The Red Sea's parted. God's allowed them to escape the wrath of the Egyptians. They've eventually made their way to Mount Sinai, where they've been there at the bottom for a little while now. Moses has disappeared up on the mountain to receive the law of God, to basically get the covenant. They've had little bits of it so far, back in Exodus 20, telling them some of the guidelines, basically of what they should do while they're waiting. Moses up there. Joshua's a little bit further down. He's not quite in the presence of God, but he's basically almost an interlink between Moses and what's going on down the bottom. And I guess It's sort of pivotal because right up until this point, this is what biblically they call a bit of a narrative point. As law's being given, so there's God basically reading out the covenant to Moses and legalistically what that looks like, how they should behave and what needs to be done in order to interact with God. But at the same time, there's a bit of a biblical pattern gets set up here. So whilst the law's being read out, there's punctuated a bit of action, like what does this law actually mean in reality? Is it a dry sort of set of legalistic codes, or is it something else? And I think this is an accusation that gets thrown at the book of Leviticus a bit, that it's just a dry book of laws. It's not. Throughout Leviticus, you get little bits of action punctuated through there, like what does this actually look like in application for people in real life? You think of the story of the Egyptian slave in the camp. His sin in there, and those type of things tend to happen throughout the Torah, the first five Jewish books of the Bible, as that continues along. And it just shows that, I guess, at the end takeaway of this little structural part is that God's law, it's not just dry and it's something to be paid lip service to. It actually has effect on exactly what you're doing right here and right now. So it's not a dead law, it's a living one. God's living, it's active, and as we get in this pretty bit of a sad episode, we're about to see what it kind of means. Basically, the people have been impatient since Moses has been up on the mountain. It's been nearly 40 days. And I guess the feeling of what's going on here is you can sort of understand it in some ways. They've been deprived of a leader, but they've also been deprived not just of their leader and their intermediary, they're deprived of the presence of God. They've actually separated themselves up from the people. They've gone on top of the hill, yet God's given them some little bit of instruction about how they should actually conduct themselves while they're gone. And I guess having that presence disappeared from you, this mighty worker, it's understandable you'd be a bit nervous, you'd be a bit anxious, there's a bit of anxiety and worry that would come out of that. If mum leaves the room sometimes, mummy, where's mummy? And the anxiety's here. Not even me, myself as a dad, can sort of sit there and go, no, Rita, calm down. It's mum that she needs in that moment. And you can almost see Israel as almost that child towards God that's still learning, that he's struggling with that absence. But I guess what they do with that anxiety and that worry is not really acceptable what comes next. This is probably the unforgivable part. They approach Aaron, Moses' brother. So just before Moses went up the mountain, he appointed two people to resolve disputes and basically sought out the interim leadership while he was up there. And his brother Aaron from the tribe of Levi was one of them. Unbeknownst to Aaron, and he hasn't heard this yet, he has a very special role to play in Israel's history, which is to become the high priest and basically the person who will end up entering God's presence up there on the mountain. The people come to him and they convince him, would you build us a deity to go before us? And it's an interesting thing from the people here, I think, as it gives an indication of where the people of Israel are at in their minds and in their hearts. Back in Exodus 20, they are told they are not to build idols, they are not to build anything which God has not told them not to do. It's a pretty big disobedience. It's one of the first, even in the interim stages, before this covenant is literally set in stone, as it's about to be, he has told them, do not do this. It's almost like the precursor warning. So, a man who had never seen fire before, a caveman would have been brought forward in time into the modern world, and he saw flames jetting out of your gas stove. You'd probably tell him, I'm going to go away for a little bit, probably just don't touch that before you go. This is almost Israel's situation. They're about to burn themselves very badly. But also in this disobedience, what they've done, they've basically reduced the image of God just to sort of a beast, like just an animal, like just something that sort of ruts around in the bushes and goes around. I think some of our translations aren't good from the Hebrew. I can't remember the Hebrew word off the top of my head, but calf doesn't really translate. More in the Near East, it comes as being a bull, like a young, strong, virile bull, like a strong animal in its prime. And in a lot of Near Eastern culture, that's sort of seen as being a royal symbol. And it's also associated probably with one of the great bugbears of ancient Israel, Baal, later on down the track. This image of a young bull seems to be quite prevalent whenever they want to sort of turn their heads away from God. Then, just to add insult into injury, they bring sacrifices, they bring offerings. And this seems so acceptable to Aaron that he even sets about basically building altars to it, consecrating it, almost in this perversion of ritual, a perversion of the role of the high priest and a perversion of the people in actually seeing this through. And engage in a festival to celebrate in a God who they see is now being present. But there's something interesting in they say, God's being present. Even though one has only made himself known to them, they're seeing a lot of others within this image that's been made. And I think there's an interesting part about golden earrings in there. There's a bit of a focus of the passage on there. And the idea with golden earrings is in the ancient Near East, so basically Bronze Age, Egypt, Canaan, up through there, up into Anatolia and maybe Troy in ancient Greece. I'm getting into speculation at that point. But ears have a bit of an interesting function. One little study I read said basically, you know, you're listening to the will of the gods or you're listening to the will of God. It's how you hear the intent of other people come through the ears. And the ears also, beyond being that, the ears are often used to show status. So often the rich would have their ears pierced and they would have gold jewels to show their social status. But even later on in Israel's history, ears are used to mark slaves. If you think about the Hebrew idea of slavery, and they did have it within their culture, the idea around that was that a slave would, a special mark would be made in his ear so everybody would know what his status was within society. But amongst rich Egyptians, they would often have earrings, and some of those earrings, and even part of the other cultures that were in the area, they would have it marked with the name of a particular god, or they'd have an inscription on that earring. So having an earring was just not a fashion statement. It was just showing where your intent was. It was showing where your heart was placed and who you were making that for. So I think in having those earrings fashioned into that golden animal, we're actually seeing they're placing their gods and where some of their faith is actually sitting right out of there. And part of that, they've done that, they're putting that faith in there, but you could also... And I heard one argument, you know, the people are acting out of fear, they're acting out of deprivation and, a hungry and thirsty person will do things if they're requiring food. But I think there's a clue in the attitude, this man Moses, this fellow Moses, they're just paying him off even to his own brother. They're trying to disconnect themselves from what's gone on before them. And I think this is even made worse by the fact that these people have experienced God in a way that we haven't seen, not in a visceral way. They've actually seen God come down and destroy the army of Egypt with the sea. The army of Egypt, it was probably the most fearsome military power in the ancient Near East. If you think of what the United States military forces, even though they're reduced, and I'm not getting into arguments about current administrations and things, they are still probably the most powerful army powerful defence force in the known world right now. To us. And that's what the Egyptians were. They, as a slave people who were under the boot of them and probably saw no way out, saw God sweep them away. They've seen God as a pillar of fire. They've even seen God descend on the mountain and they trembled at his sight. Me personally, that would make me probably obey things probably a little bit more if I'd seen that amount of power put before me. But at the same time too, as we know from our own experiences, people forget. Sometimes churches will go through the same cycle of sin. They will do the same things and get into the same places they've made mistakes before. And I think we see that in Israel. And even seeing that they had an experience of God that direct way, as if he was in the room with me now, that we haven't seen since basically Christ and the early ministry on earth. There have been other events which probably not recorded biblically, but they've seen him in a very physical, tangible way. And I think it's interesting as we look in our own Christian walk and as a whole, as a church, as individuals and as a body of believers, how often have we sinned and gone against the will of God? I know certainly from my own Christian walk, I've asked forgiveness, I've sinned, but even after my only early conversion, there was still a lot of work to do in what I did. And I think we look at these people, and this is pretty bad to go against the direct will of God. But I think in our own selves, and even as a church organisation, as we try to force something or get something out of God, we can do it ourselves, sometimes unknowingly, but it is something that can happen to us. And I even think back, to sort of my early everyman's time and the way the house was going. When we found out we were getting punted out, the rental market at the moment, sort of my approach to the Defence Force about saying I could go full time and feeling led towards that, paperwork was becoming very slow. Things were starting to slow down. And I'm ashamed to say it, but you wonder where God is in that sometimes. Some ways you're pushing me straight ahead. You're pushing me out the door. I'm here as a part of your church. I'm going to go out there and get this ministry happening. But I feel there's a barrier there. And funnily enough, as most points in my life, he always seems to come through. Just at the moment I need him. Maybe at the moment, not the moment I want, but at the moment that I need him. But I think you can understand some of these doubts. But in some ways, some of the people may have just had that doubt, but others seem to be pretty into this, even though they've been told no. And I think we've seen as a body of believers, there's a couple of failures going on here. We've seen a failure of a body of believers in not supporting their leaders, trying to lead them down the garden path, trying to get them to do things that they would not have otherwise have done out of their own desires and wants, and trying to shape a relationship with God that they want, not the one that they should have. But it's not just that failure of leadership there's not that failure from the people as a body of believers in their duties toward their leaders and God. Their hearts have already turned. There's a failure in the leaders of the body that are there. Aaron, in that whole passage, do we even hear him say no at any point? He may have, but I'm saying no because the writer of this particular passage has not put it in. And I think Aaron's complicity as a leader and the other man that was appointed alongside of him to manage affairs while Moses was gone is pretty telling into the state of the leadership of this particular body of believers at this time. And we hear these stories all the time, don't we, of leaders not just being weak, as we're seeing in this case, but also just being so strong-willed or having so much power to a point where they're directing things and places where any follower of Christ should never go. And I think it's doubly important. We just don't owe a duty towards God, but God, through the example of Jesus, we're also to serve each other. And it's the body of believers serving the leaders of the church who have been appointed there, but also the leaders serving back. And it's not always everybody enabling each other. It may be saying you might need a swift kick up the backside sometimes and stop your behaviour. And just again, ironic, Aaron has no idea, but he's just been appointed the high priest. Like, it's a bit of an egg in your face moment, I think, a bit further on down the track. I haven't included that section, but maybe something, if I do come back, I can handle it another time. But I think it's just important to note there's a double failure down here on the hill. So I'll just read Exodus 7 to 16. We'll conclude with that, and then I'll just have a few points at the end. Or I should say Exodus 32, 7 to 16. The Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people, whom you've brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They've been quick to turn away from what I've commanded them, and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down and sacrificed to it, and have said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who you've brought up out of Egypt.' I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation." But Moses sought the favour of the Lord his God. "O Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people, whom you've brought up out of Egypt with a great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'It was with evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them into the mountains and to wipe them out of the face of the earth'? Turn from your fierce anger Relent and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give you and your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he threatened. Moses turned and went down the mountain, and the two tablets of testimony in his hands. They are inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God, the writing was the writing of God, and engraved on the tablets. So I guess that absence of God, we hadn't answered the question, does he know what's going on down the hill? Yeah, he does, and the reaction's not very good. He tells Moses of this, who seems to have no idea what's actually been going on since he's left. I certainly have felt like this sometimes in different situations of my life, in the army, in corrections and in police, when I've walked out of a situation and I've come back and it's an absolute mess. And you're like, what has happened here in the intervening time? And I guess this is part of what this narrative is doing. There's two separate events going on, which are basically intertwined with one another. And I think just as this covenant, which has gone back to the time of Abraham and Isaac, even in some ways to Noah, and I guess what it's part of like that Reformed Presbyterian theology, part of what I like about it is that they see a continuous renewing of covenants and the covenants becoming more revealed as it goes on down through biblical history. And I kind of like that. This is being formalised. It's literally being set in stone. Yet here's the body of believers and their leaders throwing a massive slap in the face of God. This is pretty as heinous as it gets. It's like when I was a young soldier, and sometimes we could be a bit silly around the barracks, and somebody would walk in and go, "I couldn't leave for 5 minutes, could I?" And I think that's Israel at the moment. He calls them a stiff-necked people. And part of being that covenant is that there are conditions attached to it. And if you start going against that and sin in a particular way, it can lead to some pretty bad consequences for that. And the people are going to face a judgment which is not going to be very pleasant to them, but it is within the conditions, and God is well within his rights to carry out that judgment. And at this point in biblical history, it's really not a foregone conclusion that God isn't going to do this to them. If you think back to previous covenants and the way he's dealt with the people, there have been times where the land has been so sinful, God's had to start almost all over again. This is not foregone. This is not a conclusion that God is not going to do this. And there's a real threat that all of these people led up out of the land out of Egypt could no longer be in existence, and there might be a very small little rump. If we know anything about the nature of God, he will always preserve a remnant for himself. He keeps that little bit even if everybody's wiped out. Roland was saying about the state of Hawthorne. It may be there's a number of options that are open to this church, but there could just be this little bit that is left there at the end from which something grows. We go through a constant state of sometimes shrinking back, but we also renew as well, if our own history has taught us anything. And I think this church has let a lot of seeds in its life, and I think those will grow at points we maybe not be able to see, but it will grow up later on. But getting back to this, Moses comes to God, please don't do this. Do not destroy this nation. Remember your covenant. Remember the promises you have made to the people. He's got every right. This body of believers are just spitting in his face literally as this thing's beginning. It's like basically buying a new car and the salesman's drunk and he crashes his own vehicle straight into it just as you're leaving the lot. It's not a great start to your relationship as a people, as a nation, as a body of believers under God with what this is going, what you're meant to be going forward, being an example to everybody else. He quotes the passages that are made to the patriarchs. I will make your descendants more numerous than the stars. And I think it's interesting to note, God doesn't need to be told what his own conditions are. He doesn't need to be told what he doesn't need to do. But as we're seeing in here, so many... As I was putting this passage together, I was just thinking there's so many different ways I could have attacked it or gone down and talked about different things. But I think one of the biggest things we need to look at as we're looking at ourselves as a body of believers is one of education. Israel's going through a learning process. It is sometimes very harsh. It is sometimes very deadly. It is sometimes, you know, not a good one, but it's one that Israel does that it needs to grow as it goes through. It's seeing what God's done. The covenant's becoming more real. It's becoming more fleshed out, that progressive revelation of covenant as it goes forward. It's becoming a more visceral thing to them. They've seen God in his salvation mode. They've seen him save them from the army of the Egyptians. They've seen him brought him out of the land. He's put plagues upon the Egyptian rulers. Yet he's seen what God can do on the outside, but standing on the outside looking in, if I pull that term up again, they're beginning to learn what it's like to actually have a personal and collective relationship with God now, and they're being educated on exactly what this means. And part of doing that is he wants the people. It's only still Moses the mediator. The sacrificial system hasn't been set up yet. There's still a few things to do there, but he wants Moses his mediator. This is what I'm. He wants Moses to see this is and see this is what my nature is as God. This is what I'm like. And God relents from it. It's reading between the lines. This is a huge journey for Israel as we go through it. And I think, you know, as we look through this passage, we can think through the Old Testament as almost a series of prototypes pointing towards what Christ is going to be. You know, in King David, we have the prototype good king, even though he's pretty fallible at times and makes a lot of his own messes. In Moses, we have the prototype saviour out there leading the people, bringing them up. God even says it was you who brought them up out of Egypt. You know, in Melchizedek, we have the perfect prototype of a priest and a king put together, almost the beginning blueprint, who even Jesus says, I'm of his order. We have all these things which are pointing towards what's going to come. And how do we act as one another? But I think the biggest thing we take away from a body of believers, being a body of believers and how we interact with each other, being that example to the outside world, is just God's love for us. Even though we have gone up, we have slapped him in the face, we've literally done everything he has told us not to do, his love still exists for us, as individually, but also as a church and a body of believers. And God also remembers that. He will not destroy the earth again. He has made other promises. And in that he will preserve his church even though it makes mistakes. We are a church that is populated with fallen humans that are fallible, that are going to make those mistakes. Yet his anger is being turned away for this moment. There are other parts of this passage where Israel does meet the consequences of what's gone on. It is not particularly pleasant for them. But I think in these prototypes of showing how church works, there's only going to be one good head of it, and even Moses sins down the track. He's not allowed to enter the land where they're going. And we see all these prototypes pointing towards the one perfect intercessor. The role that Moses is providing right now in this passage is going to be taken by God's own son, which is going to come down, and all those prototypes come together in that one perfect package right then, which will be, as our body of believers, be our intercessor and be that head of the church. And I guess there's just a final point out of this. We sort of have to look to ourselves. The world is bad. It's always going to be bad. I remember doing church history, and even though we're not in that denomination, looking at the beginnings of the Methodist movement. And the Methodist movement came out of 1700s England. Its society was terrible. Prostitution was absolutely rife. A lot of the literature from the time, Moll Flanders, Fanny Hill, were books about prostitution. They were books. One was about the journey of a lady of the night up through English society. Animal fighting was quite common. You know, you know, slavery was still a present thing within, not so much within Europe itself, but in its overseas colonies was still going on. But the church itself, the Church of England, was basically one of the richest organisations with England, with a massive problem with poverty, and was not mirroring what it should be to the outside world. And that's how we get people like John Wesley, John and Charles Wesley, coming forward and going, this is not how things should be. This is not what we're called to be as a body of believers, and this is not the example we're meant to be setting. We need a better... And in that outward example, where is our relationship with God? Because if that's what we're showing on the outside, well, what's actually going on the inside? We must look to ourselves, individually and collectively, I've just said. Pick those times to stand on the outside and look in, actually have a look at our own inward, not just interactions, even as a body of believers, just with one another as we go around and what that actually means. And just also realise that the world's going to be the world at the same time too. It's going to keep doing what it was, doing what it wants. You know, even Moses, he beseeched, you know, what's the world going to think of this? You know, what's it going to do? And God seems to take that into account. But that's not the main focus. Yeah, the world, we need to be a good example, but you're not in a position to be an example yet because you have this going on right in front of you. And I guess as we look forward and as we talk about things, there's a lot going on in this passage and my head's still spinning trying to put it all together. But as seeing that, as we act as a body of believers, as we act as individuals and we look at where our hearts are with the relationship with God, to look to that perfect example, we need to look to what those prototypes come to in that body of, you know, being within Christ, being with him as the head of our church, as that organisation, and being able to... properly mirror what it means to be body of believers before God in proper relationship with him. So I'll just finish off in prayer and we'll go to the service. Father God, thank you that we can gather here today and hear your word back through history such a long time ago. But in that, God, you're just showing us what our future was going to hold and what it means to be a part of a body of believers with you. Lord, we just pray here for Hawthorne. We pray for Hawthorne's future, that your will be done in that, but that we also look into your word and we look into what examples you have shown, not just individually, but collectively together. Lord, just bless everybody here today and we love and honour you in the name of your Son, Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen.